G'day folks, and welcome to Stick With It, APA's podcast for its pilots. This is part two of our conversation with APA's Head of Legal, Matt Warburton, and our independent expert for negotiation, Peter Raffles, continuing the chat about all things with regard to industrial relations and bargaining. In this chat, we're going to discuss what might happen if pilots vote no to the EA deal, and also a bit of a conversation about protected industrial action, the pros and cons, and a little bit more discussion about the Fair Work Commission and IBD. Thanks for joining us on this chat. We'll now resume what we were discussing before.
Now, I'm curious as to your thoughts about the IR dynamic within Qantas. You know, it's got 27,000 employees and more than 30 enterprise agreements. I'm interested, so compared to, say, a company that only has one set of employees and one EA, what challenges does that create when negotiating an EA with Qantas?
Well, I have some previous experience negotiating EAs with Qantas back in the 2000s, I guess, and it was expressed to me by a Qantas manager that negotiating and being tough with unions was an existential issue for Qantas. They took the view that if they weren't tough with unions and made certain decisions, that Qantas would no longer be here, you know, in a given number of years. And so that's, I think, you know, we've seen a bit of that, how that works, and seen that in the last couple of decades. I think Qantas now seem to be at least publicly changing their communication, and they're saying that they want to engage with their employees. I think it's interesting to look at that and to look at the bargaining I've been involved in. They are, you know, I think committed to negotiating with their employees. Everyone will always ask the question, well, why don't they agree to this or why don't they agree to that? And that's to be sorted out in the negotiation. But I think that there has been some shift, at least publicly, from Qantas and their public comments about engaging with their customers and engaging with their employees. How that plays out is yet to be, seen.
But does it still present a challenge in terms of if you're in an organisation with only one EA, that gets voted up, down, whatever? Here you've got a situation where every other EA or every other work group is watching. Every time an EA gets negotiated, every other work group is watching that example. So the idea that Qantas can't be seen to, I guess, roll over or do a favour for a certain group because of the ramifications for the others, Does that then, I guess, mean whilst, yes, the rhetoric might be changing a bit and they're improving in certain areas, there still feels to me that they're still always going to be playing hardball because of the optics that all the other work groups are watching it.
Yeah, I mean, the most obvious example, the elephant in the room, is the wage freeze, right? You know, that is, they are maintaining that. In one sense, it's almost like an historical leftover from a previous management, you know, but they're maintaining it. And so that's a great example of where the rhetoric has changed a little bit, but they're maintaining a position which is, I think it's fair to say, wholly unacceptable to the majority of their workforce. And so, absolutely, they are alive to, if we make this decision now, what's the flow-on effect for that? What are other unions going to claim? But also, I think that they're pragmatic in the sense that the wage freeze has to stay, but they're willing to talk about other things, you know? And so it's that balance again between, you know, taking a pragmatic approach, but also having an eye to what happens if we agree to change the wage freeze.
A couple of key issues in the industrial employment context. Two key frames that we can use are consistency and certainty. For employees, if you own your own company, you treat some of your employees differently, you treat others and show favoritism, your morale is going to go through the floor and you're going to have tension in the workplace. And so that treating people consistently and the consistently in the EA, some people might say, well, that's about creating, being consistent with industrial precedents. But the certainty also is really important as well, not going forward for the people in the union, the people in a workplace. Certainty is key. We've got mortgages to pay. And so knowing that certainty into the future, the two things that sort of broad terms which overlay the industrial context and in particular EAs. And for Qantas, yes, they will want to be consistent.
One of the rumours that's circulating at the moment amongst the pilot body is if we vote this down 80% or better, then Qantas has to give us a better deal. And yet a refrain that comes from Qantas is that they won't reward a no vote. Is that a valid thought process, particularly given the Qantas IR landscape, both the fact that the pilots think that an 80% no vote forces the company to respond a certain way, and equally, I guess, the reasons why Qantas has this mantra of not rewarding a no vote?
So I've sat on both sides. You know, I've sat on executive management teams where you're making those sorts of decisions, and I can tell you that any decision that Qantas make will take into account all of the relevant information, and it will be dealt with in a rational way. So they will be looking at, okay, they've voted no, it's 80%, what are our options? And one option will be to improve the offer. Another option will be to not improve the offer and, you know, maintain our position. And then they'll look at, well, what happens next? You know, if we take this approach, what happens next? And if we take this approach, what happens next? So I think it's a gross oversimplification to think that an 80%, you know, no vote will result in one thing or another. That's not how it works. The management team will sit and look through the possible scenarios resulting from actions they may choose to take, and they'll make a decision based on all of the, albeit imperfect, information available to them. So, I mean, what does that all mean? Well, it means that, yeah, you could get a better outcome if you have an 80% no vote, or you may not. You may end up going down a different pathway where you lose bargaining power or where you gain bargaining power. There's so many contingencies involved in that to predict that if we take this action, this will be the outcome. It's not a real prediction.
Yeah, it's sort of building on a couple of the comments by Matt there, it's not an accurate thing. And there's an old saying, and it's a strategy known as no strategy at all. Is it out there in the public domain that, you know, we'll say no to this one and then we'll get a better deal? Yes, it is known. What are the risks associated with it? It will slow the whole process down, that's for sure. And what happens at that second level is uncertain. And will the costs go up? Yes, they will. A strategy known? It's known. And there are other ways to work with, and that is to be unconditionally constructive on the first one. You know, on put it all on the table, get it out there and get a good deal.
So based on what I'm hearing, it's very much it feels to me a little bit like a game of tennis where very much we make a decision and then it gets lobbed back over the net, and then they will assess the facts based on what has happened, and then they make a decision, and then that comes back over the net. It doesn't feel like it's sort of a preordained pathway from the start. It will be very much dependent on how each side sort of takes action along the pathway.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I like to think about it, contingencies. You know, there are actions that you can take, but once it gets lobbed over to the other side of the net, there are a whole lot of contingencies that may apply when, you know, for example, Qantas are making the decision about their next shot. So one of them is certainty. Obviously, pilots want certainty. As I said, you get nothing until you lock that agreement away. So you can negotiate all you like, you can bang the table all you like, but at the end of the day, your job is to lock that agreement away, because otherwise you've delivered nothing for pilots. And there's no doubt, I look at the pilots' enterprise agreements, and they very complex agreements with great wages and conditions that have been built incrementally over time. And so if you look at the history of those agreements, you might say, well, we've got enough. This round, we're going to lock that away, because until we lock something away, we get nothing. You know, that's one that gives you certainty. And that absolutely should be a thing to be considered by pilots when they are voting. But likewise, you don't want to get unders just because you want to lock in a deal. You know what I mean? So it's back to that balance.
So I'd frame it this way, that the back and forwards can come into a haggle, as in an offer and an offer. What we find is that there will be different preferences for any particular pilot or particular group of pilots. They will have, now that's a priority for me. I'm younger, I want to do this, or I'm older, I want this. And there'll be different priorities. So instead of seeing them as offers, but as options, and this is such a vital part of the seven element framework, is that by creating options, you begin to identify value and where the priorities can be and meeting more needs. It's a really challenging process, and it's very challenging for lawyers. And I don't, no disrespect to anyone in the room, but particularly commercial lawyers who have this history of the haggle and come in as a mediator and go, no, I don't want you to make the haggle. What I want you to do is put a package together. I'm doing one right now on the closure of a hotel. put a package together and put that across the table and then talk through it, because you'll begin to see where the priorities are and the deal will change.
I think you make a really interesting point there. I think that one of the challenges for APA is that we have 690 short-haul pilots in ages from, you know, mid-20s into their 70s. So again, different phases of life, absolutely, different requirements, different expectations. It is impossible to come up with a contract that is going to satisfy everyone 100%. Yeah. And I guess what we try to do is group in the middle, but as many people as you can, you target the things through the survey that we've done that identify, yep, what the overall important factors are, and then you shoot for those, acknowledging that you're just never going to keep everyone happy.
Yeah, it's what they say about democracy, right? You know, it's the worst system ever, except for every other system. You know, it's about the individual versus the collective, right? You know, unions are democratic organisations. If you get that balance wrong, then things may change, you know. It's always about balancing the individual interest versus the collective.
So the next thing to explore is, if the pilots do decide to vote no, do we know what happens next?
Well, again, it's contingencies. So in one sense, the ball will be in Qantas's court, because they may seek to go to intractable bargaining, make an intractable bargaining application. Either party can seek assistance from the Fair Work Commission to conciliate the dispute. That would probably happen as a matter of course, because it's a requirement in order to get to the next steps in a number of areas. So the commission will always conciliate. It's where you spend most of your time anytime you go to the commission. Or pilots may decide to take protected industrial action, and therefore then there's a ballot of members to take industrial action. So there's really a whole lot of levers that could be pulled by either side. I guess that if there was a no vote, I would see there to be a lot of risks and opportunities for both sides, and a lot of uncertainty about what happens next.
And I'm assuming, again, as we discussed in the previous podcast about fair work, time is in that, in terms of it just takes time to work through that process. I mean, even if it was the company said, well, we need to, we're happy to go back into the room to try and reframe the agreement, that requires everything from probably a new survey of members. Does the same team go again? Do we end up with a new team?
That could happen relatively quickly. There are, of course, internal dynamics for the union and for the company. And there'll be decisions being made about, well, you know, say, for example, from the company's perspective, they might say, well, should we introduce someone else into that bargaining? You know, so there'll be, you know, consideration of changing the teams, if you like, absolutely, in the interest of getting an agreement, potentially. So that's one thing, that's an internal decision that's made, but absolutely the uncertainty is the key. If you're talking about getting into conciliation in the Fair Work Commission, that happens pretty quickly. That's a couple of days.
Okay.
The application's made, within a couple of days it's listed and conciliation will start. But if you're talking about a matter being arbitrated under the various provisions available in the Fair Work Act, so that could be intractable bargaining, or it might be termination of industrial action later on down the track, then that takes, you know, months, if not 12 months. So absolutely, that would be a delayed outcome.
Yeah. And look, it's important to say to people listening, this isn't to scare you off that. It's actually just to make sure that you have a clear understanding of the different, I guess, pathways that are available to us, but also then the timeframes associated with those.
Yeah, it's just about making the best decision, you know, making the best decision with the best information available.
Matt, we discussed on the previous podcast, anyone who hasn't listened, can I recommend, we did, Matt and I spent about half an hour talking about intractable bargaining and the Fair Work Commission. Another step before that, or as part of this whole consideration, is industrial action. Can you discuss with us some of the considerations of choosing to undertake industrial action?
Yeah, sure. So look, the first thing to say is that from, you know, the days of the shearers, workers have taken industrial action to improve their wages and conditions. And actually, under Australian law, there's this thing called protected industrial action, where you're actually able to take industrial action, engage in industrial action with protection. So that's, you know, that's there. But of course,
just quickly, when you mean protection, what do you actually mean by that?
It means that you can't be sued. You can't lose your house because you engaged in industrial action and then the company suffered loss. as a result of that industrial action. So it's a civil protection that means that both the workers and the union can engage in that industrial action without the threat of civil action,
okay,
within certain guardrails, you know. So that's the first thing. It is protected industrial action. That's the concept. That said, it's obviously an escalation of the negotiation between the parties. And of course, just like we have industrial action available to us, Qantas has a lockout available to them. It's protected. We can't take action against them because they lock you out. So that is, you know, that's the scenario. The framework is designed so that there are guardrails, but they're not too close. So what that means is that because it's protected, because people have a right to take industrial action within certain limits is accepted by the law. But if you go outside those limits, then the commission has the power to intervene. And so the intractable bargaining is where the parties decide they want to come bring that to an end and have the commission arbitrate. You can have the commission arbitrate as a result of conciliation and both parties agree we're going to give the power to the commission to arbitrate. Or there can be an application to terminate industrial action that is already happening. And that's the one where the guardrails are quite sort of far apart.
And what you just said there at the end in terms of the termination,
yeah,
that's what happened in 2011?
That's right. Effectively, that's what happened. It's complex, but yeah, effectively, that's what happened. The commission made a determination and the industrial action was brought to an end.
So the actual, I guess, the mechanics of it in terms of, you know, if the pilots, if there's a decision made to go down that path, my understanding is that there's a vote of the pilots to see if that, is it also at that point as well, the pilots are actually not only just voting on the plan to take it, but the items that will be included, is that actually
that's right.
At that point?
So in order to have the industrial action be protected, there needs to be a ballot where a valid majority of employees vote to take the industrial action. And the detail, how that works in practice is that each and every detailed type of action needs to be detailed to the pilots when they vote, and they need to vote on that, and a majority of pilots need to approve that industrial action. That's the first thing. The second thing is that APA needs to give notice to Qantas of the industrial action to be taken and approved. So in one sense, once you have it approved, you're locked in. You don't have to take it all, but you can't take any action that wasn't approved by the members.
But that sounds like, just from what you said earlier, Peter, there was a strategy given is not a strategy at all. So effectively, at that point, the other side kind of gets your playbook, don't they?
That's about it.
100%.
100%. That's it. 100%. So it is predictable.
And it's not, that's not by happen chance. That is designed. So you are required to give enough information about the industrial action you are going to take in order for Qantas to make arrangements to lessen the impact of the industrial action on them as a business. That specifically is spelled out in the legislation. So absolutely, they know what's coming. They can then choose to put in place arrangements to lessen the impact, or they can choose to lock you out once the industrial action has started. So that's, again, contingencies, you know, about what's going to happen.
Now, if the actual protected industrial action was to happen, from a pilot perspective, what are, I guess, are some of the considerations or pros and cons? Because the memory of us that were around back in 2011 was red ties and some public, you know, PAs on the flight deck.
Mm.
But if it was to go beyond that, I mean, is there a financial penalty that pilots would expect to have to pay?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the legislation is specifically drafted so that there are legal obligations on Qantas to make deductions of pay when in protected industrial action is engaged in. Now, everyone thinks that they're going to be able to come up with the one type of industrial action that won't result in them, you know, having their pay docked. And I understand in 2011 their pay wasn't docked because they wore the red tie. So I'm not saying it's impossible, but I think when pilots are voting on whether they're willing to take industrial action, they should consider that most likely that industrial action that they take will result in less pay for them. That will result in their pay being docked, because that is the most likely outcome. So absolutely, they should consider that when voting.
And Pete, from a, I guess, just a negotiating framework, because again, this is a little bit like that, in terms of the pros and cons, because I guess the pilots, again, it's an emotional response potentially to say, well, let's take PIA. But when the group, a work group, decide to consider PIA, what's their objective? What are they actually trying to get the other side to do?
If they're going to take the PIA, and the first point I'd make is that that's been very carefully considered to be the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. Remember that the BATNA is the best. There could be three or four, and you can calculate the costs of that. And one of the costs in that is the time. So to go back to it, you know, if you're going to take protected industrial action, to think very carefully about it, say, well, that's the best. Are there costs? There are costs in time. And there are costs in time, not only for this EA, but into the future as well. I'm not sure how relevant this is, but there's a comment of, will it produce resolution? What's resolution? For some people, particularly where there's an ongoing relationship, there is no such thing as resolution, because the minute that resolves, you're on the roll to the next one. And one of the things that you will lose with that interruption, if the best alternative is PIA, is momentum. And that's really hard to recover. That is a cost that needs to be considered.
So, Peter, you talked about, obviously, the time associated with this protected industrial action. Can you give us a bit more about, I guess, what you would call the opportunity cost associated with, you know, the delay that can occur through PIA to actually get to an eventual agreement?
When we talk about the costs, it comes in many dimensions. And there's also a benefit side of this that needs to be considered as well. And part of the cost side is time and the uncertainty that comes around, because you go in there, you actually don't know what the expectation is. There's going to be a benefit. But is that for whom? And in the priority stakes about who's going to benefit for the membership. And so there's a cost in time of delay. There's a cost in terms of dollars as well. And there's a cost also about momentum. And that is looking ahead. Do you hold up the development of the next chapter? What's been negotiated in this deal? Is it a platform for the future? And if you take this action, does it begin to undermine that platform? And that's something for the union reps to understand, the APA reps that are at the table, who've been so hard and working so hard in this process to build a platform back with a change in the structure of the organisation. And that's something that I would be very, if I was the facilitator or mediator in this, it'd be something that I would be asking all parties about. If this ends up being disturbed by industrial action, what's the cost of that into the future, not just on this one, but into the future?
So if we're looking at being, I guess, once you're in PIA, I think what's interesting is, well, how does that story end? Where does that end up? And we've touched on that a little bit, but I'd like to explore that a bit more, that it's all well and good to you know, put the Braveheart makeup on and go charging down the hill into PIA, but how do you get out of it?
Yeah, you get out of it by agreement. So again, it comes down to that locking something away in an agreement. So you get out of it by agreeing to some terms, hopefully improved terms, or you hand over both parties hand over their bargaining power to a third party, which is the Fair Work Commission. And the Fair Work Commission then arbitrates the outcome within the legislative framework. And so there's rules about how they do that. They certainly get to listen to both sides. That's part of what happens. But that will definitely be a delayed outcome. So that's like a 12-month process, realistically. Could be shorter, but, you know, it could be 12 months or longer. That's the first thing that happens if you hand over your power. The second thing is that you tend to get a middle-of-the-road approach as determined by the third party. So what that invariably means is that there will be some things in that decision that you are not happy about at all, you know, and you will feel that you have been wronged.
And that's for both sides, isn't it?
That's for both sides, by definition. So, you know, there is, I guess, certainty. For example, once an intractable bargaining declaration is made, there is certainty. A decision will be made arbitrating that outcome. But you've handed over your power to a third party, and that outcome you may be very disappointed in. You may be very disappointed in parts of it. You may even be very angry about parts of it. But there is nothing you can do because you've handed over your bargaining power to a third party.
So the idea of going into PIA and driving Qantas back to the negotiating table, I guess tail between their legs saying, brokenness, all right, what do you want? Is that actually what happens?
Well, that would never happen, of course, because even if Qantas were broken, they would never let us know that. Because otherwise, you know, our bargaining power is much increased and we would drive an outcome that would not be good for Qantas. So they would never do that, but they may come back to the bargaining table. My experience in negotiations are that at that point, the ability to exact further improvement is limited. And I don't say that in a way of saying that you won't get further improvement, you may get further improvement, but they're going to be fairly small improvements. All the big gains have already been dealt with through discussion and negotiation. And typically my experience is that typically that process would be looking like the employer potentially giving you a little bit more of this or recasting this or changing this, but we can't go outside the what's in the pie arrangement. So I guess you could call it diminishing returns. That said, workers since day dot, whenever they got organised, they've looked at industrial action as one of the levers. So it's just one of the levers, but it comes with certain risks and certain rewards.
Well, because from what you've been saying is that there's going to be a financial cost to each individual if you took PIA.
Almost certainly.
And yet what you're also seeming to infer is that the likelihood of getting really large windfalls is actually, so sort of the return on your investment in taking PIA may not be as large as what our pilots may think it could be.
Yeah, look, that's true. That I mean, I think everyone will have different expectations as to how that, you know, pans out.
Yep.
But my experience over 30 years is that the improvements to the existing deal are relatively small or modest. Let's call them modest, yep. You know, rather than small. So yes, that's true. That said, any gains won, they're there for, you know, at least the next 4 years. And they're also sort of there in perpetuity because the next deal is going to build on them. So there is a step improvement in the conditions across the board. It's just that how much of that was due to industrial action and how much was of that was due to negotiation, I guess, is the key.
So I'm thinking that people listening to this might feel frustrated about thinking, well, what power do they actually have?
Yeah. So look, I think that pilots, first of all, have a lot of power. That would be my estimate, is that they have a lot of industrial power. But most of it comes through the negotiation, through being organised as a collective, and most of it comes through the negotiation. Then there may be some additional power through protected industrial action, but that just comes with risks. It's about making the decision with all of the facts in front of them. And the reality is that most of your wins will be through negotiation. And if you take industrial action and everything goes your way, then there may be some additional wins. That's true. That's the reward. But with that comes the risk of taking industrial action.
One thing just to touch on there that, you know, we talked, and again, I'm pointing back to the other podcast for people who haven't listened to it, but you raised the Cleanaway situation where those people were much lower paid. So they had an argument for a real cost of living issue. We have first officers that are on six-figure income who feel like they're really up against it. But what it feels to me is that going to Fair Work and arguing, I guess, a cost of living crisis for someone who's on a six-figure income, is that going to resonate? Or is it, I mean, I'm just curious
about... It's going to resonate, but it's going to resonate less, right? You know, so in one sense, everyone, we all know, we all cut our jib to, you know, to the income that we've got, you know, so you buy a house and it's got a certain level of a mortgage. And so you need, you know, and the cost of living is going up. So you need pay increases to stay up with that level that you're at.
Yeah.
So you absolutely have it available to you to say, well, we need an increase of this amount per year. But what you wouldn't be able to do, which they did do in Cleanaway, is put on evidence from people that says, I work full time and sometimes I do a bit of overtime and I can't afford to put enough food on my family's table. That's not going to be evidence that we would be able to put on for pilots. So that evidence was very persuasive and very powerful in the cleaner way, because you still have the, I need an increase of this amount per year, we'd be able to do that evidence, but you aren't able to put on the evidence about, I can't put food on the table for my family.
Now, look, it's been a very broad-ranging discussion and I've found it really interesting and learnt something. I hope those that have listened in as well have. To both Peter, maybe to start with, is there anything you wanted to just as a bit of a summary just to, or just to wrap up some any messaging you'd like to include from today's discussion?
I guess the one of the questions that got raised is about the interest-based bargaining. I mean, it's a soft option. Principal bargaining is not a soft option. You have the opportunity to calculate very carefully under one of the elements, your BATNA, and you have the opportunity to walk to it. That doesn't mean in any ostentatious or aggressive way, it just says, no, that's not something that we can accept. At the same time, the interest is the key part of it and understanding it, where the priorities are. And from the history that's been with the previous CEO, the COVID, and saying, I think for all members of the association, saying, how well does this present offer in the EA meet my interests? And then understanding what they are and their priorities across the whole membership and making a decision about it.
And Matt?
I would just say, you know, bargaining is can be a difficult process for, you know, pretty much every time you do it for people involved. But my experience so far with APA is that you've got people making the best decisions possible in the scenarios that they're given. If you, you know, you might have a different view about whether that's the best decision or not, but it's a democracy, you know, get involved, become involved in APA. You know, we've got COM elections coming up, contact the office, contact your bargaining reps, contact, talk to other pilots. That's the way you actually improve your bargaining power, is to be engaged. So I think you have a very engaged membership. I think you have a lot of bargaining power, but, you know, more engagement, the more power you have.
Okay, thanks for both of you for joining us today. It's been really interesting. And as I said, I thank everyone for listening, because I repeat the message, we're just trying to give people as much information as we can so that when you get to a point where you need to make your decision to vote, you can do that with all the considerations, you know, that you've at least thought about them before you make that decision, so it's an informed choice. Thanks very much again for listening. We'll be back with another podcast soon. In the meantime, fly safe and stick with it.